Chapter 1, Module 2, Control Systems, Energy Failure and Hidden Reserve. Homeostasis as layered control. Homeostatic variables are rarely governed by one sensor and one effector. Most are controlled by overlapping loops operating over different timescales. Blood pressure, for example, is adjusted within seconds by arterial baroreceptors, over minutes to hours by sympathetic tone and vasoactive hormones, and over days by renal sodium and water handling. The loops interact. A rapid fall in pressure triggers tachycardia and vasoconstriction, while slower renal responses defend circulating volume. This layered design creates resilience because failure of one component can be partly buffered by another. The regulated quantity is not always identical to the measured quantity. Baroreceptors sense stretch in selected arteries rather than pressure everywhere. Pancreatic beta cells respond to nutrient metabolism and membrane activity rather than to an abstract glucose set point. The brain integrates temperature signals from both the core and the skin. Clinical measurements are therefore samples from a distributed control system. A normal value can coexist with intense compensation, while an abnormal value may reflect a deliberate adaptive response rather than primary failure. Set points are also context-dependent. Fever is not simply uncontrolled overheating. Inflammatory mediators alter hypothalamic temperature regulation, so the body actively conserves and generates heat until it reaches a higher defended temperature. By contrast, hyperthermia occurs when heat gain exceeds heat loss without a regulated upward shift. This distinction explains why chills can accompany a rising fever and why treatment priorities differ in severe environmental heat illness. Gain, delay, and oscillation. Control system gain describes how strongly a response corrects a disturbance. Low gain permits a large residual error. Excessively high gain combined with delay can produce oscillation. Biological control is full of delays. Hormones require synthesis and circulation, gene expression takes time, and kidney-mediated volume adjustment is slower than a neural reflex. These delays help explain why correction can overshoot. Glucose may fall after insulin has already been given, carbon dioxide can change rapidly after ventilation is adjusted, and sodium concentration may continue to move after fluid therapy begins. Feedback can also reset. Persistent hypertension reduces the ability of arterial baroreceptors to signal that the pressure is abnormal. Chronic hypercapnia changes renal bicarbonate retention and alters the acid-base state against which an acute respiratory change must be interpreted. Adaptation may preserve function in the short term but conceal disease and create dependence on the compensated state. Abruptly reversing a long-standing abnormality can therefore be harmful. Feed-forward control anticipates demand before the regulated variable changes substantially. Heart rate and ventilation rise at the start of exercise, partly through central command and sensory input from moving limbs. Salivation and digestive secretion begin in response to sight, smell, and expectation of food. Feed-forward responses reduce the size of the disturbance that feedback must later correct. They are efficient when prediction is accurate, but can be maladaptive when a conditioned response is triggered without the expected physiological need. Energy supply and cellular triage. Adenosine triphosphate is not stored in quantities sufficient for prolonged demand. It must be continuously regenerated. Cells therefore match energy production to consumption, and tissues differ in their tolerance of interruption. The brain has high continuous energy requirements and little intrinsic fuel reserve. Cardiac muscle depends heavily on aerobic metabolism. Skeletal muscle can temporarily draw on phosphocreatine and anaerobic glycolysis, accepting lactate accumulation and reduced efficiency to preserve force. When oxygen delivery falls, the first problem is not simply absence of oxygen in isolation. Oxygen delivery depends on blood flow, hemoglobin concentration, hemoglobin saturation, and the ability of tissue to extract oxygen. Severe anemia, shock, hypoxemia, or microvascular failure can each reduce delivery by a different route. Mitochondrial toxins can prevent oxygen use even when measured delivery appears adequate. Clinical reasoning should therefore separate ventilation, gas exchange, circulation, oxygen carriage, microcirculation, and cellular utilization. Falling energy supply produces an ordered loss of function. Cells reduce energy-intensive specialized activity before they lose basic integrity. Ion transport becomes harder to sustain. Sodium accumulates intracellularly. Water follows and cells swell. Calcium entry activates phospholipases, proteases, and endonucleases. Reactive oxygen species damage membranes, proteins, and nucleic acids. If the disturbance is corrected early, ion gradients and function may recover. Beyond a variable threshold, mitochondrial and membrane damage becomes self-amplifying, and injury becomes irreversible. Reperfusion is necessary to rescue ischemic tissue, yet it can add injury through oxidant generation, calcium disturbance, endothelial activation, and inflammation. This does not argue against restoring flow. It explains why speed, controlled resuscitation, temperature, electrolytes, and the condition of the microcirculation influence recovery, even after a blocked vessel or low flow state has been corrected. Compartments, effective osmoles, and volume. Body water is divided mainly between intracellular and extracellular compartments. The extracellular compartment includes plasma and interstitial fluid. Sodium salts are the major effective osmoles outside cells, while potassium salts and organic phosphates dominate inside. Water crosses many cell membranes readily, so differences in effective osmolality shift water until the osmotic forces approach equilibrium. Concentration, content, and volume must be distinguished. A low plasma sodium concentration usually indicates excess water relative to exchangeable sodium and potassium, not necessarily a deficit of total body sodium. A person can be edematous and still have reduced effective arterial blood volume if cardiac output is poor or fluid is sequestered outside the circulation. The kidneys then retain sodium and water because their sensors detect underfilling, even though total extracellular volume is increased. Not every solute exerts sustained tonic force. Urea contributes to measured osmolality, but crosses many cell membranes and is therefore often less effective than sodium at determining cell volume. Glucose becomes an important effective osmole when markedly elevated, drawing water from cells into extracellular fluid. This movement can dilute measured sodium. Interpreting fluid disorders requires asking which solute changed, whether it crosses the relevant membrane, and how rapidly the disturbance developed. Rate matters because the brain adapts to persistent osmotic change. With chronic low extracellular tonicity, brain cells shed electrolytes and organic osmolytes to limit swelling. Rapid correction can then dehydrate adapted cells and damage myelin. With chronic hypertonicity, cells accumulate osmolytes. Correction that is too rapid can promote cerebral edema. Exact correction limits are context-sensitive and must follow current local protocols, but the underlying safety principle is universal. Chronic adaptation narrows the safe rate of reversal. Reserve, compensation, and decompensation. Reserve cannot be inferred reliably from a resting measurement. A person with early cardiac dysfunction may maintain normal blood pressure and oxygen saturation at rest by increasing filling pressure and neurohormonal drive. Exertion reveals breathlessness because cardiac output cannot rise appropriately and pulmonary pressures increase. Similarly, serum creatinine may remain within a reference interval despite substantial loss of filtration in someone with low muscle mass. Function under stress and the trajectory over time can be more informative than a single apparently normal result. Compensation has costs. Sympathetic activation preserves perfusion, but raises myocardial oxygen demand and constricts some vascular beds. Renin-angiotensin-aldosterone signaling retains volume but can worsen congestion. Hyperventilation partly compensates for metabolic acidosis but increases respiratory work. Bone buffering of chronic acid load protects extracellular acidity at the expense of mineral stores. A compensatory response should be recognized, supported when necessary, and not mistaken for correction of the initiating problem. Decompensation occurs when demand exceeds reserve or when compensation itself becomes damaging. Warning signs include rising work of breathing, altered mental state, falling urine output, increasing lactate, deteriorating mobility, and slower recovery after minor stress. These trends often precede collapse in a headline vital sign. Repeated assessment matters because physiology is a trajectory, not a photograph. The practical synthesis is to ask 5 questions. What variable is being defended? Which sensors, integrators, and effectors are involved? What compensation is currently preserving the measured value? What energetic or structural cost is that compensation imposing? Finally, how much reserve remains if demand rises again? Those questions turn homeostasis from a definition into a clinical method.